Today's session, which will look at area-wide planning, Superfund sites, environmental justice, and green infrastructure, and how we can tie it all together in the Freeport Community Planning Project, which has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA, Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Today's session is scheduled to run from approximately 2:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll be joined by another moderator, Michelle Mahoney, from that very same office, as well as a number of presenters joining us from various locations across the United States today. Before I turn things over to Michelle for speaker introductions and to kick off the technical part of today's session, I'm going to cover a few housekeeping items and reminders so that everyone knows how today's session will be operated. Our entire live broadcast will be delivered online using a tool called Adobe Connect. With this tool, our presenters will be able to control movement through a series of PowerPoint presentations so that our participants can simply sit back and watch as they deliver their talks from various locations. If you have any problems with the online meeting tool, the materials are available to download from the seminar homepage. That's the same page you would have been sent to check in for today's webinar. If you're missing that URL, I'll encourage you to go back to your registration emails as well as reminder emails that had all of the information you'll need to join us for today's session. Those emails, again, will ultimately point you to that seminar homepage where you can find the slides, find contact information and bios for our speakers, even provide feedback after the live delivery. For now, to make sure you can join us in the online interactive Adobe Connect environment, you'll want to click on the button that says Go to Seminar from that page. You'll be asked to identify yourself, the number of people at your location, and then you'll be checked in and brought to our Adobe Connect environment. Again, any problems with that process, you can simply download the slides and follow along manually. Audio is available online for all participants through Adobe Connect. If you're having any problems with your local or your volume settings, I'd encourage you to check your local volume controls first. You may need to adjust the volume settings on your computer or mobile device. Some speakers find that using a pair of headphones or external speakers will improve the quality. If that doesn't work, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Feel free to use the Q&A box in the lower right-hand corner to request a call-in number at any time. But please know if you join us on the phone lines, we will place you on a global mute, and we ask that you remain globally muted to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. That Q&A window is one of the boxes you see on the screen in front of you today, and it will appear in the lower right-hand corner throughout the entire webinar. There's already a welcome message from me, Jean Ballant. Again, you can type up comments, questions, as well as report technical problems at any time using that Q&A window. In fact, you can feel free to test that window out now. Feel free to send a message, say hello, let us know how the weather is, or if you're really excited for today's upcoming webinar. Other participants won't be able to read your questions or comments, but again, we encourage you to submit them as soon as they occur to you. And then at designated points in today's session, our moderator will stop and read questions out loud to our presenters so they may address them. Today's session is being recorded, and you'll receive an email as soon as that archive is available. You'll be free to forward that email on to anyone that you think will find it to be a valuable use of their time. And if you'd like to browse the nearly 550 archive seminars that we already have, you can check out our clue-in page that we have listed at the bottom of slide 2. Just a quick reminder, again, to check in for today's webinar, you're going to visit the seminar homepage, which is the same page you used to sign up for today's session. You'll click on the Go to Seminar button, and that'll prompt you to identify yourself and join us for today's live broadcast. Once you come into the online environment, you should see a series of windows on the screen in front of you. The main portion of your screen towards the left will show a copy of the PowerPoint presentations that we're using. If you have any problems viewing that content, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper right-hand corner. You can click that at any time to make the slides larger. You can click the full screen button again to shrink the slides back down. Along the right-hand side, you'll see a series of boxes, including our sponsor's logo in the upper right corner, a collection of related URLs in the middle. Those are actually active hyperlinks. You can click them and press the Browse To button at any time to open up those websites. And I encourage you to browse the resources that have been pulled together by our presenters. And then again, in the lower right-hand corner, that all-important Q&A window, which will let you submit questions, comments, and report technical problems at any time. Simply click your mouse cursor in the empty box or field at the bottom of the Q&A window and start typing away. When you're done, hit enter or press the little cartoon bubble to the right to privately submit your question or comment. I think that's the end of the technical reminders I have for today's session. I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to Michelle whenever you're ready.
Great. Thanks, Jean. Welcome, everyone. Today's Superfund redevelopment webinar. This is part of a series that we've been doing for quite a few years now. Today's topic is area-wide planning, Superfund sites, environmental justice, and green infrastructure, tying it all together in the Freeport Community Planning Project. We have some wonderful speakers today. We have five people who are going to give some presentations to you, the first of which who is Melissa Friedland, who is with us here at EPA in the Superfund program. She's the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Program Manager, and I'm going to turn it over to her to kind of kick off our session and give everyone a background in the program and all that good stuff. So, Melissa?
Thanks, Michelle. Good afternoon, and welcome to our first webinar of 2014. As I'll explain shortly, this is a very special year for the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, and I'm thrilled that you all are joining us today. We're going to be discussing a community engagement and planning project in the community of Freeport, Illinois, and I'm very glad that you'll have the opportunity to hear from a number of folks closely involved with the project. I'd like to begin with a brief introduction to the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and tell you why Superfund site reuse is an EPA priority. And then we'll hear from Tom Bloom, the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator from Region 5, who'll give us a bit of background on the project and the history of the contaminated sites in the area. And then we'll hear from Shelley Griswold from the City of Freeport, who'll share a bit about the community and how the project was brought to Freeport. We'll hear from Sarah Malpass from SCIO Solutions about SRI's regional seed project. And finally, we'll hear from Ronnie Bush from the Eastside Stakeholders Group, who will speak about the impact the project has had on the community. But first, I'm sure you're wondering, why is this year so special for us at SRI? It's special because we're celebrating the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative's 15th anniversary this year. And over the past 15 years, SRI has been involved in the reuse process at many sites. We found that sharing the stories of successful reuse projects is one of SRI's most valuable tools, and we're excited to do that during our webinar today. We'll be celebrating with events and projects all year long, and this is just the first of four special webinars we'll be holding throughout our anniversary year. So please visit our webpage frequently, as new information will be posted regularly. Let's get started. The next. Okay. Restoring, revitalizing, and bringing economically productive new uses to Superfund sites is a vital part of EPA's work. Communities have been reusing cleaned-up sites for many years and for a wide variety of purposes. During the past 15 years, SRI's directly supported efforts to return Superfund sites to productive use. Our mission at SRI is to work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. We work at a national level, developing policies, tools, and performance measures that help support reuse activities, and also at a regional level, supporting specific projects and sharing lessons learned. Shall I go over these pictures? Yeah. If you look at the pictures in the slide, it shows a community planting event that was held at the Chemical Commodity Superfund site in Olathe, Kansas, and an SRI regional seed, which we'll talk more about later, is supporting a video about the site that highlights its transformation from a contaminated chemical facility to a pollinator migration corridor, restored native prairie, and a walkthrough teaching habitat. And EPA Region 7 deserves a lot of credit for recognizing the many site stakeholders with a LEAF Award, Leading Environmental and Forwarding Sustainability, in 2012. EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but our thinking regarding when to consider reuse in the remedial process has evolved over time. In recent years, reuse has become an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. Sometimes there's a misconception that redevelopment and reuse cannot happen at a site until the remedial action is completed, but I want to be clear that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. When reuse is considered early in the process, the EPA site team is in a better position to help communities and stakeholders return a site to productive use. stakeholders' wants and needs can be integrated into EPA's cleanup process to support both cleanup and enforcement requirements and the future use of the site. And if you look at these pictures, we've got an Excellence in Site Reuse Award at the Calhoun Park area site in South Carolina, and the picture on the right is the American Chestnut Foundation is piloting a new blight-resistant chestnut. And these plantings are part of forest restoration efforts at the Palmerton Zinc site in Palmerton, Pennsylvania. During the past 15 years of our work, SRI found that site reuse provides a variety of economic, environmental, and social benefits. Commercial reuse of sites can support new jobs and added income to a community. We've seen increased public revenue and property values at and around sites where reuse has taken place. With vested interest and long-term stewardship of the property, reuse also leads to better protection of human health and makes a site less likely to be a target for vandalism or illegal dumping. Sites may also provide recreational opportunities and restore valuable habitats that would be otherwise unavailable. So not only can reuse provide direct benefits to the local community, but it helps achieve cleanup and enforcement goals. And if we just take a quick look at these pictures up at the top, this is an example of residential reuse, including ENERGY STAR certified homes in Salt Lake County, Utah at the Kennecott site. We've got the next one is commercial reuse at the Murray Smelter site in Murray City, Utah. And we have a model airplane park, another example of recreational use, at the Taylor Road landfill site in Hillsborough County, Florida. When reuse is considered early in the cleanup process, a site is in a better position to achieve EPA agency goals and apply the reuse tools provided by SRI for returning the site to productive use. Agency goals related to reuse are reflected in the 2010 EPA Reuse Directive, which instructs EPA regions to consider and implement reuse at Superfund properties throughout all stages of the cleanup process. Reuse is not just considered by SRI. All members of the site team should have returning the site to a productive use in mind. So here we have the general categories that a site moves through as it makes its way through the Superfund process. And as you can see, the reuse directive applies to all of these categories. Reuse planning and in the appropriate circumstances implementation can take place at any point during the Superfund pipeline. Whether you're looking at reuse while developing remedial action objectives for the site, when selecting a remedy, during remedy implementation, or even during long-term operation and maintenance, reuse can inform the cleanup process in a way that helps ensure the long-term protectiveness of the site, opens the door for economic revitalization, and provides social benefits. We have tools and resources available through SRI that are critical to supporting the agency's strategic plans and goals, including the Reuse Directive's mandate to explore reuse throughout the Superfund process. So this slide just highlights a few of the tools available through SRI. We have something called the Return to Use Initiative, which aims to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. We work with the regions to find ways for headquarters to potentially help address barriers on a site-by-site basis. We then share those journeys in demonstration project fact sheets with the hopes of reaching other communities and site teams looking for inspiration or solutions for reuse questions at a Superfund site. And if you can, that's on the left side of your screen. We also have something called Ready for Reuse Determinations, or RFRs, which provide a single summary document outlining that a site is ready for reuse. It documents that a contaminated site has been characterized and cleaned up to the extent necessary for specified current or future types of uses, as long as the use limitations identified continue to be met. The use of the RFR determination is proven to be valuable for dealing with confusion over what future uses are appropriate at a site and helpful in facilitating the public and private reuse of sites. We also do something called a site-wide Ready for Anticipated Use, or site-wide RAU, which is a performance measure to report the Superfund program's accomplishments in making land ready for reuse at construction-complete sites. The measure reflects EPA's priority on reuse as an integral part of the agency's cleanup mission for the Superfund program. Through SRI, EPA helps stakeholders actively participate in the cleanup and reuse of sites. The way that EPA has done this has evolved over the past 15 years of our program history. Initially, a pilot program was developed to provide local governments with services and grant resources for public outreach and reuse planning. In 1999, SRI provided 10 pilot grants to eligible local governments. Between 1999 and 2002, the grant program expanded to include 70 communities who received program assistance. And based on the lessons learned during these pilot projects, the process to support reuse planning activities evolved into what we now call regional seeds. And these regional seeds are resources that SRI provides to communities at the request of EPA regions. While they do not fund environmental assessments, cleanups, or actual site redevelopment, regional seeds do provide an initial investment to help communities and EPA regions work together to find the right tools to move reuse forward. And if we just take a quick look at these pictures, the one on the left is recreational reuse at the Avtex Fiber site in Front Royal, Virginia. This site was one of the initial SRI pilots. And on the right is a community working session for reuse planning for the Picayune wood treating site in Mississippi in Region 4. And in addition to reuse planning for the site, EPA is working to develop an eco-curriculum to be shared at an elementary school adjacent to the site. There is no one-size-fits-all approach to Superfund reuse. SRI understands that each site and community present a unique situation with unique needs. However, regardless of the type of site or cleanup status, regional seeds provide an important catalyst for communities to begin the reuse process. And while regional seeds can support other reuse activities, the majority of regional seed funding directly supports site reuse planning. Many sites have reuse potential but remain vacant or idle because stakeholders lack the understanding of the remedy components, the types of potential future uses, and the key steps and players needed to return a site to beneficial use. The seed concept kickstarts the process by bringing the right stakeholders to the table, clarifying the remedy and any constraints on reuse, and outlining the community's goals and suitable reuse options to pursue. For example, the Fairfax Street Wood Treater site is located in an environmental justice neighborhood in Jacksonville, Florida. The site area has potential to serve as a community amenity, and an SRI regional seed funded a reuse planning process to identify reasonably anticipated future land uses and potential stewardship opportunities for the site. Part of the process involved meetings with community stakeholders to identify likely reuse stewardship scenarios, and that's the picture up at the top. And at the Fairfax Street Wood Treater site, the reuse framework for the site was developed as part of the regional seed. However, the planning process did not end there. SRI's regional seed was matched by EPA Region 4 to develop a full reuse plan for the site. This is a key part of the regional seed process. Collaboration between SRI here at headquarters and the regions is critical. As the reuse planning process started by the regional seed moves forward, the region must step in to continue to support these projects and follow up on their progress. Communities can leverage the initial regional seed investment with resources from local governments, stakeholders, the state, or the EPA region to continue the process. Several SRI regional seed projects, including the North Birmingham and the Jacksonville Integrated Planning regional seed projects, which you can see here, as well as the Freeport regional seed projects we're discussing today, have been leveraged through additional funding from the region. The Freeport Community Planning Regional Seed Project is being matched by EPA Region 5 to develop a full reuse plan for the Freeport Riparian Industrial Corridor. As we discuss in this project today, you'll see how regional commitment to reuse and reuse planning can leverage SRI's initial investment in a site's reuse project. So if you have any questions about SRI or if there's anything I mentioned in this brief introduction that you'd like more information about, don't hesitate to get in touch with me. We'll provide contact information at the end of the webinar, and we'll also have some time for additional questions. But now, I'd like to hand things over to Tom Bloom.
Let me get my screen up here so I can advance my slides. And I think I'm there, except for I don't see anything yet.
Okay, Tom, before you do that, I just wanted to go over one question. Somebody asked what the LEAF Award is that Region 7 awarded. And
sure.
I want to get this right. So it is the here we go. It's the Leading Environmentalism and Forwarding Sustainability Award, LEAFS.
Okay. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Tom Bloom. I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in Region 5. I've been at it since about 1999. We've got over maybe 100 communities here in Region 5 that I've worked with to try to identify opportunities and to work around the challenges to meet those opportunities to put sites back into productive reuse. My talk today, I'm going to give a little background about the role of Superfund Redevelopment in Region 5, share some examples of reuse projects, and then talk a little bit about how the Freeport project came into my radar screen and how we progressed along with that project. First of all, I'd like to explain that, you know, Region 5 is made up of several states. It's the states of Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin. And the way that the process started out was that we would look at sites that were in the remedial investigation and feasibility study part of the cleanup process to try to focus a cleanup towards an end use. We would work with the local communities to put together a conceptual plan, and then that plan could be used by the project manager and the cleanup team to kind of sculpt the cleanup towards an end use. So when the site was done, it wouldn't just sit there chained up with a skull and crossbone sign, but that somebody was ready to jump on it and use it afterwards, be it a commercial, recreational, industrial, or ecological reuse. Why would we spend $3 or $4 million to clean up the site just to let it sit there all screened up? Then what happened was the process went a little bit further, as Melissa mentioned, and we looked at some of the sites in the remedial design phase. Could we do certain things to add value to the remedial design that would help out with the reuse? For example, could we move over our pump and treat plant so that we could open up for a parking lot? Or could we flush mount all of our groundwater well sticks so that they'd be flush mounted with a vault that would be locked that we could grass over so we could use it for a soccer field in the remedial design phase, so that when we were done, we were ready to use it for the end use that the community had come up with. We also looked at some of the post-construction cleanups, the sites that were already cleaned up, and why weren't they being reused? Was there a problem with it? Was there a stigma problem? Was there a liability problem? Nobody wanted to touch the site because they were worried about Superfund liability. Or maybe was there a administrative problem where we had a restrictive covenant that said no further occupancy, and we had to change that legal requirement that was being overly protective, even though we cleaned it up for certain types of uses that would be okay. Back in 1990, 1989, we still wrote into the remedy no further occupancy after we cleaned it up. So that's kind of how we evolved. We started out with just trying to inform the investigation towards a focused end use, but then we looked at also remedial sites that were remedial design and remedial action construction, and also sites that were already cleaned up to see what we could do to add value to help it turn it from a community liability into a community asset. And some of these projects, we worked with a lot of local stakeholders. We try to get a diverse group of stakeholders to get everybody's opinion, to educate everybody as to what's going on there. And they turn into general categories like commercial, recreational, industrial, or ecological. So I'm going to go to my next slide and talk just about a couple of little projects that we had here in Region 5 that kind of highlight what we did here. First of all, we take into consideration when we do these projects the land uses, the infrastructure, the community priorities, and the market trends. And while the Freeport area project is an area-wide planning project, we also have done renewable energy projects, recreational and commercial revitalization, put together conceptual plans, and also just help facilitate a process with the local stakeholders to move from point A to point B to get the site put in back into reuse. So one of the first sites I wanted to talk about will be the waste ink site, and that's a landfill that was in Michigan City, Indiana. It's a 32-acre property, was once an industrial landfill. The city came to me and asked for some assistance with reuse planning. We provided that planning in 2011. We did information gathering, stakeholder interviews, and we came up with a reuse assessment that looked at reuse goals and site remediation features. What was really neat about this project was we came up with some suitability mapping. where we showed certain slopes on the landfill that would be suitable for recreational uses, slopes on the landfill that were too steep that we wouldn't necessarily want to do certain types of uses on, other parts of the landfill that, let's say, we had a borrow area that where we could make it a parking lot, and we kind of put together a little recreational plan. There was already a recreational plan out there called the Trail Creek Corridor Plan, but this just kind of highlighted it and put the site along with it. And it's working out really great. This greenway is a central component for the Michigan City's economic development strategy. And now I've got a little article that I pulled from the paper. It's dated November 10, 2013, where it says the LaPorte County officials are moving forward to turn a mountain of trash along Interstate 94 into a major tourist attraction with ideas of zip lines and slopes for sledding. And so this is really something great that's come out of this process. It's moving forward. There's some people quoted as saying that it might take a few years to get to fruition, but they're very excited about finally converting this blighted area, this mountain of trash that was once a mountain of trash at the entrance of LaPorte County, into something that's an attractive, desired destination. That's the Lake County landfill. And let's see, what some interesting bits about this one was, once we found the borrow area, we knew that that would be a good place to put the parking lot because there's no place to park for open space there. Dog park considerations came up there, and that's very interesting, talking about dog parks and some of the things that go along with a dog park. It seems like the owners are more of a problem than the dogs are. And then the potential for zip lines and some of the liability that goes along with zip lines. The next project would be the Butterworth Landfill Project. That's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's about 120-acre landfill. It's been cleaned up for quite a while. We worked with the community a long time ago in 2009 to put together workshops to ask what the community wanted to have done with this property. Educating them, explaining them that it's been cleaned up, how thick the cap was, what could be done, what couldn't be done. Everybody wanted a piece of it back then. The BMXers, the soccer people, the skateboarders, the model airplane people, the fishermen wanted it because there was a small dock on the Grand River there. What was neat about this project was the RPM paved the maintenance roads around this 20-acre landfill because it would be more cost-effective to pave them to come back and re-gravel them when they washed out every couple of years. It's a large site. They needed to get around on the sites to do monitoring and do operation maintenance. So this paved trail made it perfect when the city came to me and said, there's a bike trail on one side, there's a bike trail on the other. Can we use some of these paved trails as a connector trail to go from one site to the other? And that's what we did. We worked with the community to put this bike trail together. We cut the ribbon for a couple of years out there. Kids are riding along the bike trail now. The rugby people want to make a rugby feel out of it. And just recently, the city wants to improve their renewable portfolio. So we did a renewable energy assessment out there and looked at the option of installing solar panels on there, looked at the substations, where the wires would go, who would take the energy once we produced it. And we're moving along there with a renewable energy plan. The next site that I was going to talk about is the GM site. This site is one of the first area-wide planning sites we came to. Initially, what happened was this site goes through a couple of different jurisdictions. We've got Lansing Township. This is the former GM plants 2, 3, and 6. And when GM went bankrupt, they basically leveled this entire 300-acre parcel just on the west side of Lansing. And since we had Lansing Township, we had Lansing, we had a lot of other community stakeholders, we wanted to do an area-wide approach here. And I thought that one of the good things about this project was that we worked well with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, Lansing Township, the City of Lansing, local developers, other state agencies. Initially, we wanted to look at some renewable projects on this, but then we realized when we started getting more into reuse planning and information gathering that this was even more valuable, that it had good traffic counts along the major road there, that, okay, we could do renewables, maybe more industrial renewables on the inner portions of the plant, but let's do more commercial and out on the outer portions where you have good traffic counts. Let's do stuff that's very open and that you can take advantage of the people, the cars coming, going past, and seeing what's going on there. Also, in the northwest corner of this project, of the site, there's heavy traffic congestion from a nearby school. The children, the parents, when they drop the kids off, they can't go left. They get all backed up. So one of the things that the responsible party out there, Racer Trust, was willing to do is open up one of the gates in the plant to let moms and dads drop their kids off in such a way that they wouldn't have to worry about getting stuck in traffic afterwards. It also helps the kids to walk a little bit, because instead of getting dropped off in front of the door, they're getting dropped off across the street a couple block away, and it's good for the kids to get a little bit more exercise, you might say. Here's some contact information. I've got a whole bunch of these projects. I like to talk about them all the time. It's great to work with local communities, state agencies, counties, responsible parties, soccer moms, model airplane guys. These sites come to me from the project managers, the on-scene coordinators, developers, cities. I never really say no to anybody. Sometimes I don't have the time and the money to invest, so I say, I'll put you on my radar screen when I get to you, and then we'll work on it. And this Freeport project was one of them that I had to put on the radar screen, and then when we got the funding and the time to go, we went out there and started doing our thing out there. Who's talking next? Am I talking next again?
I believe I'm next, Tom. No,
okay.
I, now, no,
okay,
I,
wait. All right, let me turn it over to you, Shelley, because I still have to do my...
Tom.
Oh, I'm still going. Right. Okay, let's go.
Yeah. Tom,
hey, now we're getting
up
a little bit more into the Freeport project. How did it come to my radar screen? Well, the on-scene coordinator knew the mayor out there, and they had talked about it when they were doing a cleanup at the CMC property site. And the mayor said, you know, the site is right in between two major bike trails. If we could get a bike trail across it, we could connect people with that like to bicycle up to northern Wisconsin and go down into southern Illinois. The on-scene coordinator told me about that. I said, I'll put it on the radar screen. I don't have any funding to have my reuse consultants come out and do conceptual plans out there, and I'm kind of busy, but I'll get to it. I met the mayor then at a Brownfields conference in Louisiana and introduced myself, and we talked about the project, and I said, I'm going to come out there in a couple of years, and we're going to see what we can do out there. So that's kind of how that went there with that one. What's neat about it was that in this area, that generations of industrial activity to kind of expand transportation in the area, when we went out there and we did some information gathering, we found out it wasn't just the CMC property sites, but there were several sites that had kind of negatively impacted this area. That this area had a stigma, there's stigma associated with it, and how could we add value to help this community out to return these sites to reuse, to put this bike trail in, and to use some of these other sites that had been blighted to help the community get back to something that would make it an asset, not a liability. And so that's kind of how that one kind of got started. When we finally got out there, okay, so now let me just talk about a couple of the sites that were associated with the Freeport project. One is the Burgess Battery site. That's right across the street from the CMC property site, and they manufactured batteries from 1926 to 1998 there. There was manufacturing operations contaminated the groundwater and the building itself and some of the soil. We did a time-critical removal there. There is an EPA Brownfields pilot grant issued in 2001. Illinois EPA Brownfields redevelopment grant and municipal funds were used by the city to work with the responsible party to successfully clean up the site. When we did that, afterwards, there was another funding assistance from the EPA that was a $50,000 Brownfields pilot green space grant, and that helped with a recreational reuse of the Burgess Battery site, which is now called, I believe it's called the Tutty Connection, and it's a public boat landing. It's got bike trails on it. One of the interesting bits about this thing, and there's some old silos left on the sites, and the people out there when we were information gathering were saying the ice climbers love those things in the wintertime because ice forms on the side of silos, and every once in a while you see somebody climbing up with their ice picks up the side of the silos at the Burgess Battery site. The next project is that was in that right along the Pecatonic River in the east side area was the Raleigh complex, and this is a 450,000 square foot complex building that they manufactured household goods and all kinds of chemical types of materials from 1904 to 1989, then they filed for bankruptcy, left the building alone for several years. It decayed, trespassers, vandalism happened out there. EPA stepped in. We did a removal action to clean up the leftover chemicals in the storage tanks and the asbestos and the mercury that was in the building. There's 500 tons of contaminated soil, additional 210 drums of liquid waste that were moved from this plant. Then the community got a brownfield assessment, pilot grant in 2001. They formed a committee of stakeholders to generate redevelopment plans for this complex. And I believe today Shelley's going to tell us a little bit more about it, but I think it's been converted into an art center, and it has art-related businesses, and it's a regional tourist attraction, the Raleigh Complex. The last site that I was going to talk about is the CMC property site. That's the site that brought me to the area. I told you a little bit about how I got involved in it, how I got put on my radar screen. It was an 18-acre site that basically was the... It was a Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad switching yard and a railroad right-of-way for several years. And then the 18 acres were leased out to various companies, including two oil manufacturing company, oil facilities, rather, with tank barns and underground storage tanks, paint manufacturer, mattress company, lumber yards, and then it was abandoned and left over. That's when EPA went out. We did an assessment. We found stuff was left behind that needed a time-critical removal action. That's when Steve Perrion went out there as the on-scene coordinator and removed a massive amount of lead-contaminated, stabilized and removed a massive amount of lead-contaminated soil. I think it was close to 7 tons of soil was removed, backfilled the area. He did a really good job. He went above and beyond the OSC duties. He worked with the community to do an educational exercise at Taylor Park Elementary School, and they constructed 9 bat houses and 3 wood duck houses and mounted them on trees at the CMC property site, trying to, you know, give a little bit back to the community. In addition, that's when he identified to me that the city wanted to construct a bike path from Talley's Corner, that's the Burgess Battery site, through the CMC site, and that would lead to the James Adams Trail. Now, by the time I got out there to start my information gathering, we found out that half the bike trail was already built and they were working on the bridge. So as we were doing some community information gathering, we realized that there's a little bit more to the project there, that this community could really help out with some area-wide planning, that they had gotten kind of like a bad reputation for a blighted area. There wasn't any place to buy groceries there. They had some disproportional regulations on them, and they had to do with floodplains. And so we launched into a full-blown, information gathering, area-wide planning process to look at several of these sites, how they impacted and how to work with the community to address some of the issues that are out there. And with that, I am going to let Shelley Griswold from the City of Freeport tell you a little bit more about the Eastside community and how this Freeport project went. Shelley?
Thank you, Tom. Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be with all of you this afternoon. My name is Shelley Griswold, and I am the Director of Community Development for the City of Freeport, Illinois. I'm going to provide a little bit of background information about our city and about the Eastside neighborhood in particular, give you a little bit of context about the project that we worked on with Tom and his crew and with SCIO Solutions. So the city of Freeport is located in northwestern Illinois. We're about 20 miles south of Wisconsin and about 60 miles east of Iowa. We're known for being one of the locations of one of the historic Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858 when Abraham Lincoln was running for the Illinois Senate. And so that's our big claim to historical fame in Freeport. Today, we provide a center of economic and cultural activity in our area. We're the largest community in northwest Illinois, west of Rockford, and north of the Quad Cities, because we're in quite a rural area. So our population of 25,000 is really the biggest in the region. And the median family income is about $35,000. We have been incredibly fortunate over the last 15 years or so to have a partner in the EPA, the US EPA, and we've done an awful lot of environmental assessment and cleanup and brownfield reuse for contaminated sites, primarily in the east end of our town in the downtown area, a lot of the work in the east side neighborhood that we're going to talk about today. So we have some experience turning those brownfield sites into drivers for economic revitalization and reinvestment. Tom talked a little bit about the Raleigh complex. We've been working on that site for more than 10 years. The city acquired it after two young boys went into the building. It had been abandoned since the really the late 80s. Two young boys went in and they broke into some mercury vials and some of the machinery there and took home mercury and contaminated themselves in their homes. And that sparked an emergency removal action, and that's where it all started. We hope to transform the Raleigh complex. We have one out of five buildings in private ownership. On our March 3rd City Council meeting, we'll have a measure to take another one back into private ownership. And that's where our Amtrak multimodal transportation hub will be, as well as the other tourist-related attractions. The Eastside neighborhood is a predominantly African-American community right out east of the river, east of our downtown area. So this whole yellow neighborhood is the on the map is Eastside, and this large rectangle here in the northeast part is Taylor Park. So the residential part of the neighborhood really is concentrated in the rest of the yellow area here. It's predominantly African-American and is cut off from the downtown by the river and a railroad crossing. The residents of the east side have a really strong attachment to their neighborhood. Lots of people have been there for generations and have a great affection for the neighborhood. A lot of people remember a time when the neighborhood was really booming and thriving, and now because of a number of factors, that's not really the case anymore. It's been impacted, the neighborhood's vitality really has been impacted by flooding. Because it's located in a regulatory floodway. Residents contend with major and minor flood events on a fairly regular basis, and they're subject to FEMA and Illinois floodway regulations, which really inhibit the ability to improve their homes and buildings. These regulations, which were not in place when the neighborhood was built, make it quite a challenge to improve and expand housing or neighborhood businesses. So over time, that's led to disinvestment and decline in neighborhood and commercial businesses. The neighborhood also has experienced quite a strained relationship with the city due to perceptions about unequal enforcement of floodplain rules and other faltered revitalization efforts. So this strain has really stymied a lot of our efforts to move forward with neighborhood improvements. Jean, can you advance the slide? I'm having a little trouble with my computer again, please. Thank you. So the Pecatonica River, it runs right along the western side of the neighborhood through downtown Freeport. And we have frequent flood events. We're awfully worried right now because there's a lot of snow, and as the snow melts, we're a little concerned that we're going to have some flooding this spring early. They're not considered severe by FEMA and state agency standards, but they disrupt neighborhood life, and particularly on the city's east side. FEMA is responsible, as many of you probably know, for designating floodway areas. A floodway is the area where the water flows during a storm event. So you have floodplain regulations, and then you have even stricter and stronger floodway regulations. Virtually the entire east side is located in a regulatory floodway, which severely limits the ability to improve properties. The city of Freeport's responsible for enforcing those regulations, and the consequences are pretty high. If we don't enforce them, we could be kicked out of the flood insurance program, which means no one in the city could buy flood insurance, and we could lose our eligibility for federal disaster assistance. So the city's been in a little bit of a difficult situation with the need to enforce those regulations, on the other hand, knowing that really there's a disproportionate impact on folks in the east side because house values there are so depressed that, you know, you can't hardly put $4,000 or $5,000 in a house before you reach that 50% floodway maximum. So it's a pretty difficult situation. Jean, would you mind advancing the next slide, please? Thank you. So here's a few slides of some of the flooding on the east side. So, you know, it's been, and you see from the picture on the top left that, you know, it's been happening for a long time. That picture is from the 19-teens sometime. And then the two below are a little more recent. Jean, slide. So as I mentioned, you can't improve by FEMA regulations more than 50% of a home's value if it's in the floodway. If you want to improve more than 50%, then you have to elevate that structure at least 1 foot above the base flood elevation, which could be cost prohibitive. So that really puts a lot of limitations on the east side neighbors on how they can maintain and improve their homes. And it's a disproportionate impact. For example, if you have a neighborhood where the average home value is $200,000, a homeowner in the floodway could make home improvements of up to $100,000 before they reach that 50% cap. However, the east side median home value is a lot lower than that. In a community where homes are often worth less than $10,000, even very small improvements can quickly trigger regulatory requirements. And this has really prevented east side homeowners from making any significant improvements in their homes, and has caused a significant amount of resentment toward the city of Freeport, who's responsible for maintaining those regulations. So this has led to a continued cycle of disinvestment and deterioration and declining economic stability for the east side residents. Next slide, please. So as I said, the city of Freeport has partnered with EPA for a long time, with Brownfields, with Superfund, and now with SRI. We met with Tom Bloom in 2011 to discuss opportunities to highlight success, the site reuse at CMC Heartland and look at other opportunities that we could capitalize on to improve neighborhood quality of life with the remaining space. The city identified opportunities to foster a broader conversation about neighborhood quality of life in the east side, improve the strained relationships, and address revitalization. And we really have a pretty significant amount of success with these goals, which you're going to hear about with the next two speakers. As a result of these discussions, SRI identified funding for us for a planning effort that focused on capacity building for neighborhood residents, and city staff as stakeholders examined opportunities to improve neighborhood quality of life, looking at lots of things, including stormwater and floodwater mitigation, recreational opportunities, all manner of different things. Next, Sarah Malpass with SKEO Solutions is going to talk to you. Sarah was a member of our facilitation team. We worked very closely with her and the Polywide Planning Grant that will focus on the same neighborhood and area and build on the success and momentum generated by the SRI process. And I'll just put a plug in before I pass it over to Sarah for if any of you that are listening haven't really taken advantage of some of the partnerships available with EPA, I would strongly encourage you to do so. And if you are at the very beginning stage of any of these projects that can take quite a long time, I would challenge you and encourage you to hang in there, because I've been doing this for 9 years, and the city had worked on it for a number of years before that, and sometimes it takes a long time to get to reuse in a beautiful site, but gosh, it's sure worth it when you can see the results in your community and see neighborhoods improved and properties revitalized and economic development. So Sarah, I will go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you, Shelley. Good afternoon, everyone. Well, this is Sarah Malpass. As Shelley said, I work with a consulting firm called SKEO Solutions and was a member of the team that provided facilitation and planning services for the City of Freeport and EPA on this project. And building on what Shelley shared about the community context, I'm going to walk us through the planning process that we used in the East Side neighborhood and share some of the lessons that we learned as we went through the process with members of the city staff and members of the community. So EPA Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and EPA Region 5 sponsored this reuse planning process for the CMC Heartland site and other contaminated properties in the east side neighborhood of Freeport. And the project connects site reuse with area-wide neighborhood revitalization for this environmental justice community. So over a 12-month planning process, we worked with neighborhood stakeholders, and they identified two primary goals for the planning effort that they were hoping would set the stage for broader neighborhood revitalization. So the two primary goals for the planning process were the reduction of flood impacts and the reduction of impacts of floodway regulations on the neighborhood, which, as Shelley mentioned, were quite disproportionate compared to other neighborhoods in the community. And so the stakeholders, the neighborhood residents' hope was that if these two goals could be addressed, there would be a significant improvement in the ability of the neighborhood to make investments in quality of housing, recreational assets, commercial assets, et cetera. The planning process that we went through with the community involved six key steps that are listed on this slide. We started with a needs assessment that helped to identify key concerns from the residents, from city staff, and other stakeholders. And that needs assessment led to a training on building cultural competence that I'll share more details on momentarily. We followed that capacity building training with a series of workshops that focused on neighborhood revitalization, green and gray infrastructure solutions for reducing flood impacts, and finally a working session to help neighborhood residents refine the message that they wanted to share with FEMA representatives, who are ultimately responsible for the floodway regulations that impact the neighborhoods. Finally, our team worked with the community to produce a report that helps capture the community's goals and recommendations for integrating reuse of the contaminated sites in the neighborhood with strategies for reducing flood impacts and moving towards comprehensive neighborhood revitalization. And I think that report has been made available to folks as one of the resources associated with the webinar. I should also say that the six steps that we went through with the community weren't predetermined from the beginning of the project. That was really one of the key pieces that was helpful in facilitating the project's success. We used the needs assessment as a really important tool to help tailor the flow of the project, specifically addressing community concerns and roadblocks. And then throughout the process, we really constantly reevaluated workflow and process to make sure that the conversations with the community were really focusing on areas where the planning process could help the community move the ball forward for community revitalization. So next, I'm going to share a little bit more detail about what we sought to accomplish during each step of the project. These pictures show two of the meetings that took place during the needs assessment. The image on the top was taken during the first public meeting that we held for Eastside residents. And contrasting that, you'll see on the bottom a picture that was taken during our meeting with a group called the Teddy's Crossing Coalition, which is a local organization, a coalition that is interested in the restoration of the Pecatonica River and revitalization of the waterfront, outdoor recreation, et cetera. I think you can see from the two meetings that there's quite a difference in the demographic of folks that attended the Eastside Stakeholders meeting versus the demographics of folks who attended the Teddy's Crossing Coalition meeting. And not surprisingly, concerns and priorities that were raised at the two meetings were completely different, almost at opposite ends of the spectrum. At the community meeting, residents raised issues about lack of access to basic commercial amenities, a pressing need to address substandard housing, and their sense of the city's lack of responsiveness to neighborhood concerns. Whereas at the Teddy's Crossing meeting, Teddy's Crossing Coalition members raised issues like a desire to reconnect recreational trails along the river to the broader regional trails network, and the coalition members' frustration that neighborhood residents weren't more active in coalition cleanup efforts along the river despite repeated invitations for residents to participate. And as our team worked with both of these groups, we really got the sense that there were pressing needs in the neighborhood from the residents' perspective that were just completely different from what folks outside of the neighborhood were experiencing in terms of their interest in recreation versus the neighborhood's interest in day-to-day improvements like better housing and access to commercial amenities like a grocery store. So the conversations that we had with city staff and Eastside residents and the Teddy's Crossing Coalition during the needs assessment resulted in a number of different observations and outcomes that helped shape the project moving forward. There was the recognition that residents and outside groups had differing priorities in terms of revitalization. It also helped us to think about how to target future outreach efforts to neighborhood residents appropriately. You may have noticed in the picture on the previous slide that there were four or five neighborhood residents who came to our initial meeting. We had hoped for greater turnout and spent some time talking with them and getting their recommendations on how to advertise future meetings. And so their recommendations were to focus on places of worship as well as direct mailings to neighborhood residents, and that turned out to be quite successful over the course of the project. We also received a recommendation from the East Side residents. So we hold planning calls and engage residents prior to the meetings that would be held in the neighborhood so that key neighborhood stakeholders could help set future workshop agendas. And then finally, through conversation with neighborhood and city staff members, we identified the pressing need to heal relationships between members of city staff and residents of the neighborhood. So following the needs assessment, we decided to take the next step of hosting a training in the neighborhood that would engage both city staff and neighborhood residents to start to directly talk about some of the long-standing tensions between the city and the community. So SCIA Solutions brought in a team of folks who could provide a building cultural competence training. It's a training that's tailored specifically to the communities that we work in, but in general, it is a training that helps to create an atmosphere where folks can address longstanding issues in a context that builds trust and understanding. We focus on building interpersonal relationships that can be used to catapult conversations forward that have been stuck in the past. And then the training also allows participants to have a safe space to explore some of the sensitive feelings and experiences with the goal of creating a shared context for moving forward. So in particular in Freeport, one of the issues that we were seeking to address was the sense from many neighborhood residents that the community has long been overlooked because it's a predominantly black community in a predominantly white city. And the training really provided a space for folks to honestly and openly talk about race and some of their concerns in a way that had not been done before and built relationships that really helped facilitate the dialogue moving forward. So the next slide just includes a few quotes from members of the community and the city staff who participated in that training. One participant said, "I didn't realize how committed city workers are to improving living conditions on the East Side." Another participant said, "I really liked how the training helped us think about things we already know about culture and gave us tools to start improving our relationships." My favorite response was one participant who invited all of the city staff to come to their house for a family barbecue the next weekend. And then there was another participant who said that we wanted to host another training to include elected officials, housing authority board members, and more, to move forward with more positive relationships between the city and the neighborhood. And that tone really helped move the project forward. So the day after the Building Cultural Competence Workshop, neighborhood residents convened for a second meeting to focus on neighborhood revitalization. This workshop was structured to allow the community to respond to goals that were set forth in a 2007 plan called the East Side Revitalization Strategy. This pretty recent planning effort had succeeded in outlining an action plan for revitalization on the East Side, but following completion of the plan, a coalition of neighborhood representatives and resource partners who had been charged with implementing the plan had faltered, and many of the action items in the plan were never implemented. And so there was a sense of discouragement and planning fatigue in the community. We wanted to start our neighborhood revitalization conversations by acknowledging that some really important work had been done by neighborhood residents and city staff in 2007, and finding ways to overcome the obstacles that the previous coalition had encountered in implementing that plan. So meeting participants at the Neighborhood Revitalization Workshop discussed the 2007 plan. They also discussed current neighborhood needs. And out of that discussion, they identified three revitalization priorities, including improvement of housing conditions, identifying suitable economic redevelopment opportunities for brownfield sites, and increasing neighborhood-oriented amenities and services like a grocery store, a sit-down restaurant, a laundromat, and public transportation that would facilitate residents getting to other commercial areas in the city. Participants also agreed that it would be necessary to address flood impacts, as I shared at the beginning of this section of the presentation, in order to set the stage for those important neighborhood revitalization goals. So the two goals in terms of addressing flood impacts, as I said before, were reduction of flood impacts on residential areas and reduction of impacts of the floodway regulations. The residents also documented flood impacts in particular areas of the neighborhood and prioritized areas for addressing those impacts through reuse of contaminated sites. As you can see on this map, the neighborhood flood experience map was an important piece of the neighborhood revitalization workshop. This was the first time that flooding locations and perceived direction of floodwaters had been captured visually from the residents' perspective. Community residents seem to really resonate with seeing their experience documented as opposed to seeing other technical maps that had been developed in the past. And they were really excited about the opportunity to use this map as a tool for communicating with regulators and decision makers who were used to looking at more technical documents, but not so used to looking at a document that really captures what it feels like to live in a neighborhood like the East Side. And I just want to pause here for a moment and talk a little bit more about the feeling I think that this map conveys. One of the things that residents really emphasized during the production of this map was that it feels like water is entering the neighborhood from all sides. The neighborhood not only is surrounded on one side by the Pecatonica River, but also Courier Creek, which you'll see in the upper left-hand or upper right-hand corner of the map. And you can see the direction that residents understand floodwaters to be entering the neighborhood, really coming from all sides. And then in addition, residents recognize that there's a really high water table in their neighborhood, so there's really very little capacity for the water to be absorbed by the ground. And when you consider rain events, the map really begins to give a sense that the residents are surrounded on all sides by water, and that there's a sense that you feel like the neighborhood is drowning in some ways economically and also through their lived experience during flood events. So they were very excited about being able to use this as a tool for communicating, not so much as a technical document, but as a tool for communicating their own experience of living in this community. A month later, we reconvened with neighborhood residents to start to dig deeper into strategies for reducing flood impacts. And so at this green and gray infrastructure workshop, we worked with neighborhood residents and city staff to evaluate opportunities for improving neighborhood conditions by addressing gray infrastructure needs, things like stormwater systems and sidewalks, and then adding green infrastructure features to publicly owned lands and brownfields to increase the neighborhood's capacity to absorb that stormwater. This next map shows locations that community residents prioritized for flood impact reduction efforts, and you'll see those areas highlighted in red and yellow and blue. They're overlaid on a map that shows locations of brownfields and publicly owned land in the neighborhood. And workshop participants use this map to help to start prioritizing goals for reducing flood impacts and finding ways to implement green and gray infrastructure strategies on brownfields and publicly owned sites. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of publicly owned land in the neighborhood in addition to privately and publicly owned brownfields. So a lot of opportunity here to take advantage of sites that are typically seen as having negative impact on the community, but an opportunity to see those sites as having the potential for reuse and implementation of green infrastructure projects. So workshop participants spent quite a bit of time sorting through various goals for reducing flood impacts. And you can see the goals that they ended up with listed here on the slide. there was a lot of interest in prioritizing green infrastructure projects that would address areas where floodwater was entering homes and impacting private utilities. There were also a number of streets where residents had experienced floodwaters completely blocking street access during flood events, and residents decided they were very interested in low-impact development projects that could focus on that kind of spot flooding. Also interested in ensuring safe access for children, parents, and staff at Taylor Park Elementary School. The road that the school buses used to drop kids off was frequently impacted by flood events and created an unsafe environment in some instances for dropping kids off. There was a particular area of East Stevenson Street, which is the main thoroughfare that divides the neighborhood north and south. A sidewalk project had created standing water, and there was significant interest in introducing gray infrastructure improvements that could help address that standing water on East Stevenson. And then finally, making sure that green infrastructure features were designed not only to be functional, but also to beautify the neighborhood and the entrance corridor into the city, the city's downtown. So one of the outcomes of the workshop was that participants affirmed that they wanted to see a combination of green and gray infrastructure improvements in the neighborhood. And I'll just talk for a moment for those who aren't familiar with the green and gray infrastructure terms that I've been using. So gray infrastructure is what you might think of as the built components of our landscape, the sidewalks and streets, stormwater and sewer. And so gray infrastructure strategies that the neighborhood was interested in was focusing on repair of broken and blocked components, upgrading undersized and dated stormwater or sewer infrastructure, and adding new drainage networks that could help increase the capacity of the gray infrastructure to handle the volume of stormwater that the neighborhood experiences. And then on the flip side, if gray infrastructure is the part of the built environment that helps handle stormwater from a man-made perspective, green infrastructure would be the natural features and sometimes the constructed natural features in the neighborhood that can help to overcome limitations of gray infrastructure. So things like natural and constructed wetlands, planted swales next to sidewalks, and planted stormwater retention areas. So green infrastructure strategies can help to temporarily and safely store stormwater until it has time to drain. It can be used on vacant properties, Superfund sites, brownfield sites, publicly owned lands, and right-of-ways. And as a part of the final report, we produced an addendum that catalogs specific strategies that the neighborhood was interested in seeing implemented, and so you can look there for further information. In addition to endorsing some specific green infrastructure strategies, the Eastside residents also spent quite a bit of time putting thought into considerations for how those strategies should be implemented in the neighborhood. They talked about the need to layer multiple strategies for maximum effectiveness, focusing not just on one strategy or another, but really implementing a network of strategies that would address multiple concerns. They were very interested in being involved in design and construction of these initiatives, including seeking opportunities to apprentice neighborhood residents who were out of work or looking for work, and perhaps seeking to move folks who are out of work into through a training program or apprentice program into longer-term job opportunities in landscaping. They were quite concerned that green infrastructure features be designed in order not to promote mosquito habitat, and indeed there are a number of different strategies that can be used in green infrastructure to address that concern. They wanted to make sure that design was safe for children. There was a particular concern from neighborhood residents that increasing standing water in the neighborhood might, in some cases, create a safety hazard in terms of drowning. So interested in having resident input into design to ensure safety for kids. They wanted to include observational areas and educational signage so that the infrastructure was not only serving to reduce flood impacts, but also to educate the community, both residents as well as folks from outside the community who might use the recreational trails along the CMC property, other areas along the Pecatonica, to describe the features and the wildlife that the green infrastructure was attracting. They were also wanted to make sure that there was an adequate maintenance budget, wanted to make sure that plantings beautified the neighborhood, and then interested in working with the state as well to address debris blocking the flow of the river so that as the storm water that was being processed by these green infrastructure features entered the river eventually, it would have the capacity to move that water on downstream. So the next step of the process was to work with residents to prepare for a conversation with FEMA. One of the important things that residents realized over the course of conversation with the city was that, as Shelley mentioned, while the city is responsible for implementation and enforcement of the FEMA floodway regulations, the city has no control over the conditions of those regulations. And so the neighborhood was quite interested in working to develop a consensus message about the disproportionate impact of floodway regulations on their community. And we used an elevator speech exercise to help residents practice developing a focused and effective message for government agencies. One of the things that residents identified as a challenge was that at many public meetings in the past, residents would all come and have disparate messages about what the problems were, and that government agency representatives often ended up feeling overwhelmed and not taking home a specific targeted message about what they could do to partner with the neighborhood to help improve the quality of life. And so we used this exercise to help them develop the following message, and I'll just read this out. It's in residents' own words, and I think it's really important. Participants came up with a message saying, floodway regulations have a disproportionate impact on housing values and housing quality in low-income neighborhoods. The majority of Eastside residents have difficulty maintaining and improving homes because of floodway regulations. Eastside residents would like FEMA to address the disproportionate impact of the 50% rule and would like assistance with maintaining and improving their homes. And going forward, as you'll hear from Ronnie, who's the next presenter, residents have continued to meet and are continuing to use that consensus message to put together a presentation and a dialogue that they hope to engage in with FEMA here as FEMA comes to share some updated floodway maps. So they are working collaboratively towards that meeting. So finally, as we wrapped up our involvement as consultants during this phase of the process in Freeport, we worked with the community to complete a final report and addendum. And as I mentioned, those should be available to you all as resources through the webinar website. And then stakeholders are continuing to prepare for this conversation with FEMA. Just reflect on a few of the lessons learned through this process before passing the conversation off to Alderman Ronnie Bush. The area-wide planning process was really important for this community in order to expand the impact of the reuse of the CMC site. We really focused on supporting an integrated quality of life-based plan that identified the residents' priorities. And we talked about this a little bit at the beginning of this section, as the Tubby's Crossing Coalition had significantly different goals for reuse and revitalization in the neighborhood and the Pecatonica River than the residents did. And so it was really important to lift up the voices of folks who actually live in the neighborhood and think about ways that area-wide planning and could be used to raise quality of life for folks who are actually living in the neighborhood. We also worked really hard to build capacity for collaboration and partnerships, and that was a key part of what made the project so successful in the end. The building cultural competence training opened up an opportunity for new conversations to start between residents and city staff. And that really set a positive tone at the beginning of the process that had not previously been present in the dialogues between the city and the neighborhood. We also focused on using communication tools that empowered and educated stakeholders. So the maps that were developed were reflective of stakeholder comments, and we responded to stakeholder concerns about technical maps by introducing images of different low-impact development and green infrastructure techniques, and you can see those images reflected in the final report. We supported stakeholder-guided engagement and outreach, listening to the community about which places of worship should be used as opportunities to notify residents of meetings. And then we also focused on building effective partnerships for implementation, so ensuring that key city staff and elected officials were at every meeting and were there to emphasize that the city truly is committed to being a partner with the neighborhood as they move towards implementation and as they move towards dialogue with FEMA. So I'm going to pass it off to Alderman Ronnie Bush, who's going to talk a little bit more about the stakeholders' perception of the process and the impact that the process has had on neighborhood residents.
Pod, that's in your Adobe Connect room, and we're getting a number of questions coming in now, and we're going to address them once Ronnie Bush is completed with his presentation. But please feel free to continue to submit those questions, and we'll address them in a little bit.
Okay, thank you. First, I want to thank Sarah for what she had done coming to Freeport and helping out with the process. Pretty much what she had talked about is pretty much overlapping of what I have to say. But I'll move on here to the next slide with the community expectation. The planning fatigue, there was a lot because the residents has been through numerous meetings, and they just felt that, you know, why come to another meeting when nothing never come out of it? And because they felt that when they do go to a meeting and make their suggestion, that they never been heard to, you know, they wasn't, nobody wouldn't listen to them. And then also, too, they felt that they're more or less being used to be able to go out for grant, and once they get the grant money, they went elsewhere with it. So that's what a lot of that, with the fatigue and the tension around the racial discrimination, had a lot to do with. And then the confusion over the enforcement. A lot of them just didn't really, they just misunderstood what misinformation and on the red tape of the codes, and then they get the quite understanding of that. So that's what a lot of that was behind of the confusion. And then also too, as I've stated before, that with the unproductive expectation about future interaction, they just felt that, you know, why get involved when they felt like they wouldn't be listened to, or they're taking the ideas and what elsewhere with that. Next slide, the key turning points of it, the need assessment. Well, I think that really helped out a lot, and it did, by having city workers coming over and sitting down talking with the residents and where they got a feel of one another. That helped out a lot, and that never has been done before. And now both sides got the chance to interact with one another and talk to one another, so they got a better understanding where each person stood. With that, the outreach effort and endorsement by key neighborhood leaders, that's going to have to continue on going on. And I think that to the point now that we have to quit pointing fingers at each other and start sitting down and talking with one another and getting things done. And with the building cultural competence, that helped out a lot. That really did. And I think that that's something that needs to go on all the time, and I'm hoping that it will. as I stated before, with Sarah and other ladies that came out, that helped out a lot. They felt really, really good about them, and I did too, because I've been in numerous meetings, and I just really felt good about them coming, and I really felt that I think we really could get something done. The flooding experience, you know, by them going on and mapping out the different areas that was flooding to them with the Courier Creek, with the Peck, and with the drainage and stuff like that, that was a big plus as well. And hopefully that'd be a valuable tool to use. With the green infrastructure, that's something that's never been done before or talked about. And once that was really explained to them, to the residents and everything, they really bought into that. And like I was saying, they like to do more different area, different types of infrastructure on that instead of just sticking with one. And then also to do some type of educational tool. But I think whatever be done, the residents have to be totally involved in this because, like as I stated before, they just felt that when they come and make the suggestion, then they don't see nobody no more or they just walk away. But I think they have to be totally involved with whatever's going on. Now, we did go through the elevated speech exercise because we are planning on making a presentation to FEMA, which will be this Tuesday coming up. And we've been really sitting down. We appointed two people to speak. We are doing a PowerPoint presentation to them. But we've been really meeting. In fact, we'll be meeting Saturday morning, and we're going out to encourage the other residents to be able to be at this meeting. Because we're really realizing that if it's good that we are making a PowerPoint presentation, but it really sells, I think, that if we have a room full of residents there in support, that it'll speak more loudly than by us just talking. And then also, too, that we're hoping that FEMA will buy into what we're saying. And then we still want to take them on a tour. I know right now it's probably impossible of doing that, but hopefully that we could be able to get them to come back and we'll be able to take them on a tour. And then also, too, that they'll be there with the flood maps so the residents get a chance to look at that. The history of the flood regulation, it really had hurt that neighborhood totally. I remember born and raised in Freeport, and I remember that the neighborhood was a very thriving community. It had a lot of businesses, families, a lot of things going on. And also, too, the east side of town was the start of Freeport. But then after the flood regulation came in, it just kind of took hold that whole neighborhood to whereas that it's dying, but the people that over there is there because they want to be there. And they really would like to have their neighborhood back to where it used to be. And how that is, well, businesses or like you mentioned about grocery stores or laundromat, you know, because right now they want something, they have to run clear across town to even get a loaf of bread. Some type of service to businesses over the inside of town would really help out a lot. And then also, too, the major concern is people not being able to do anything with the houses or their homes. They only could go 50%, and that really putting a hurt on a lot of people over there that want to do things with the house. If FEMA could really work with us to either soften or reduce the 50% rule or somehow or another identify any kind of assistance of maintaining or improving the home will really help out a lot. So that's pretty much all I have to say at this time. So I'll turn it back over to whoever is next.
Okay, this is Melissa Friedland. We have a couple of questions. Tom Bloom, are you still there?
Yep, I am.
Okay, great. So let me ask you the first question. Let's see. The first one.
The very first one.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, it's a question about developers and cleanup and reuse, and I think you'd be the right person to ask the question. So do developers ever pay for cleanup once there's been a reuse? And how does that happen with paying for cleanup?
Yeah, Melissa, we have had a couple of instances where developers did pay for some of the cleanup. We put together an agreement with them. I believe that Matt Sanders from your office, our legal liaison, would be able to help out more with the details on that. But we've had developers that have come forward and say we want to pay for part of this cleanup, and we have been able to legally include them and make them, you know, prospective purchasers and shelter them from Superfund liability. And it has been done, yes.
Great. And we have another question. I think, Tom, I'm going to start with you on this question also, that there's a question about the role of EPA in this project. And how is the state involved or the county? I don't know if this is you and Shelley, but I assume we started our work here because it was a Superfund project.
Yeah, it came to me through the on-scene coordinator. But when we do our information gathering and we try to get a diverse group of stakeholders out there, we include the state regulatory. We ask everybody, do you know anybody else that would be interested in this project? So we try to get the state regulatory agencies in there. We try to get everybody that's included in it, even the responsible parties if there is a cleanup at one of the sites. We try to get a diverse group of people out there, because if you only have a couple of people step forward, you're not going to get the good information. You're just going to get biased information from those couple of entities. So the more people you can get out there, when we go to one person, we ask them, do you know anybody else? And then we go to that person, do you know anybody else? So when we're trying to get as much input as we can from the neighbor, the community, and the local stakeholders out there.
Great, Tom. Thanks. And we've got a question now. Mr. Bush, I was interested to hear you say, this is our community. We don't want to leave. We've been here for a long time. So what would your response be if someone said, you know, well, why didn't EPA work to move this community out or tell them to try to relocate them somewhere else?
Well, you know, that relocation had come up before. But it's just the fact that a lot of people, that's home. I mean, they love being over that on that east side of town. That's home. They were born and raised there. That's a very touchy situation with a lot of residents over there.
Thanks. I've got another question. Tom, I think this one is for you, too. Is there some interest in the Environmental Justice Office in the region? How did you work with them on this project?
Sure. Well, I kind of report out to them on our activities on a periodic basis. So I've got, you know, several sites that are on my radar screen that we're working with environmental justice communities, and I give them an update periodically on how we're doing, where we're going with it. And so they're aware of that.
Any other questions at this point?
Anyone else has any more questions, we encourage you to continue to submit them using the questions pod in your Adobe Connect room. But at this point, Moses, do we want to move to your...
That sounds great. Okay. So I want to thank all our presenters today. It's great to hear in depth about a successful project like this. And as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, SRI has found that sharing examples of successful projects and lesson learned is one of the most effective tools for promoting reuse. We think that it inspires stakeholders with opportunities and vision. It shares tools and resources that help facilitate changes, and it provides hope to communities struggling to find a silver lining at a contaminated property. I just want to remind you that we have a number of additional resources on our website, and you can take a look at additional reuse planning project examples and get more information. We also have fact sheets that highlight successful reuse, as well as technical reports and in-depth sheets. And these resources cover everything from strategies for reuse of sites where waste is left in place to economic impact case studies. And I just would feel remiss if I didn't mention partnerships. which is one of our great resources. We're currently partnering with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Pollinator Partnership, and the Trust for Public Land. And we've worked with these partners on several successful projects, and we can provide you with additional information if you're interested in a specific type of reuse. We've found that these partnerships are a great way to open the door to exploring reuse opportunities and available resources. And all of these organizations are familiar with Superfund and are willing to work with interested communities. So I encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page on our website and learn more about our partners and the unique skills and tools and resources that they can bring to the table. I see that we have another question, how are environmental justice areas designated as such? I'm not sure who should take that question. Tom, do you want to take that question?
But it's a very easy answer for me. We have a database. I plug an address into the database. I think anybody can get to the database. Now, I don't know how they put the database together and they categorize things as EJ1, EJ2, and EJ3. It might have to do with the average income in the area, the cost of housing in the area. I'm not sure. But for me, it's kind of I just go to a database, plug the address in it, and it tells me whether it's an EJ community or not. And I believe that is available to anybody.
Yeah, and I know that if you look online, this is another comment coming in that I actually, if you look online in EPA and environmental justice, you'll find all kinds of information. I think the agency is working very hard to try and figure out how to make sort of standard designations, if you will, because I think everybody can approach this very differently.
Say, Melissa, I have a couple of things to say, too.
Sure.
One is I wanted to just point out that was what was kind of neat about this project was that when we met with the community and when we had these meetings, you know, we know that, you know, most of us want to, you know, when we have a public meeting, we might do it in the evening. We might do it at times that are convenient for the people that are doing the presentations. But with this one, we did it more for the convenience of the community. They said, if you have a meeting on Wednesday, 7 o'clock, we're not going to get anybody to show up. If you have a meeting on Saturday at 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock, that's when we would like to have a meeting. So we had these meetings on Saturdays, not Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. So I thought that was kind of neat that we were able to do that. The other point I wanted to make is how Superfund Redevelopment Initiative can kind of move on their feet. You know, we went out initially after I talked to the mayor about doing reuse planning for the CMC property site for a bike trail, but then when we went to do information gathering, we found out that there was other impacts to the community, not only from the CMC site, but from several other sites, and we found out how these impacts were negatively influencing the community, and we also found out how there was a communications problem between the city and the community and tried to work with that, too. So those are two things I wanted to point out that were pretty neat about this project was that we were able to, you know, have the meetings at the times when the community could be there, and that we were able to kind of move on our feet to add value and not just come up with a conceptual plan for the sake of coming up with a conceptual plan.
All right. Thanks, Tom. I just want to close with a couple of more things. I want to remind you all that we have Superfund redevelopment coordinators in every region. And we work closely with them, our collaboration allows us to identify Superfund sites that can benefit from reuse-related engagement and assistance, like our regional seeds. So if you refer to this chart, you'll see where we've how it's broken down by region. And then my last thing that I wanted to say is that we do have a lot more information about this. We're always happy to talk about it. So if you do have questions, please don't hesitate to contact me or visit our website. And I want to thank you all for joining us today. I want to encourage you all to sign up for our next webinar, which will focus on the reuse of Superfund sites as solar facilities. And the presenters will share their site-specific perspectives on working together to accommodate environmental considerations while working to generate economic impacts for site stakeholders. I know that climate change is on all of our minds after this winter, so I hope you'll join us in April, where maybe it will have stopped snowing, to learn about these innovative strategies and finding renewable energy resources. So thanks today for joining us, and I'd like to hand things over to Michelle and actually...
You can ask Jean that question.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Melissa. I just want to let everyone know and remind you that this is an ongoing webinar series on Superfund redevelopment topics. We have 19 webinars that have been archived, and you'll see the link to those archives here. And this webinar today will be archived, too, and should be available within the next 2 weeks. And you'll receive an email when that archive is available. And our next SRI webinar looks like it's scheduled to occur in April, so keep your eye out for that, and we hope that you'll join us for that webinar. The other thing I'd like to let you know is we do encourage you to give us feedback and fill out the feedback form. Let us know what future webinars you'd like to learn about, and maybe at this point, Jean, it might be good to bring up the survey that we have, the survey layout, and where we could maybe get some immediate feedback from those of you who are still on the line. We're just wondering, you know, what types of topics you'd like to hear more about. If you have any, specific topics that you'd like to suggest for future webinar topics, there is an area where you can manually type that in the right-hand side. We have a mailing list where we can send you announcements for future SRI webinars. You can choose to give us your email address in the bottom left-hand pod if you would like to receive that type of information. And then on the bottom right-hand side, we have put together a number of different resources associated with this webinar that you can click on. There's a fact sheet about this website. There's the online feedback form, the main seminar page, which will give you all of the contact information for our speakers. The Superfund redevelopment webpage, all that information can be found within those related URLs. It looks like we're still getting people responding a little bit to our poll. But we've got a great response here. It looks like a lot of people want to hear more about ecological revitalization, green infrastructure, reuse planning. These are all great topics, and it's nice to see, at what level people are interested in one topic over another. So, Jean, maybe it looks like people are wrapping up voting here. So perhaps do you want to go back to the resources slide? And maybe it would be good for you to walk through that.
Yes, indeed.
And then I don't know if you saw, we also got a question for someone wanting to know about how to get some continuing education credits for the webinars, and I know you have information about that.
Absolutely. So I'm going to go ahead and just walk through a couple of final reminders for today's session as we get ready to close things down for today. For those of you that are looking for a copy of the presentation materials, we do have those available to download from the seminar page. You'll see that in the middle towards the right side of your screen, there's a box called Related URLs. If you click on the word for Seminar Resources, you can download the slides from that page. They'll be active on that page from this point forward, so if you're actually watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you too can follow those links to access the materials. The same goes for our feedback form. I will ask each participant to take just a few moments to fill that form out. We do read each and every one of the responses, and we count on your comments to help us to continue to deliver future Clue-In sessions. So please take a moment to fill out that short form and let us know what you thought. If you shared the line with multiple parties, each person can actually fill out their own feedback form. When you click the link to fill out the form and complete it, there'll be a page that'll pop up that'll have a link to let the next person hop on. If you don't have time to fill that form out or you're watching the recorded version of today's seminar, you can come back to that feedback form page at any time and fill that out. So again, we encourage you to submit your responses whenever you can. For those of you that are looking for credit for participating in today's seminar, for either CEUs or PDHs, we don't necessarily issue training certificates as well as copies of the presentation materials and submit feedback. There's a box you can check on the feedback form to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. And that email will at least verify you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you take that confirmation email with the registration email and the seminar materials, you should be able to verify and document your participation to earn credit for today's webinar. If you have other questions or need further help in documenting your attendance today, feel free to send me an email directly at ballot.gene@epa.gov. As Michelle mentioned, today's session will automatically be archived, and everyone who signed up for today's webinar will get an email as soon as that archive is available. It usually takes us about 2 weeks to produce them, so just keep your eyes peeled. Once you get that archive, you can certainly feel free to forward that on to anyone else that you think it'll be a valuable use of their time. I want to thank the time of all of our presenters and organizers who helped put today's webinar together, and for the nearly 90 individuals who joined us from all over the country for today's live webinar. Thank you all so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.